Crying out for mercy, Mormons helping Mormons, and a community of suckers. I'm Justin Katz, and this is Last Impressions number nine. Well, first of all, let me apologize for the cheesy Beatles reference with the number nine. I wasn't going to do it, but then I figured I only get to do the ninth one of these one time. So might as well get it done with. And then hopefully everybody who thought it was too cheesy can forget about it in the not too distant future. So I opened up there. The piano is Mercy, Mercy, Mercy by a guy named Joseph Zawinul. I've seen it printed, not spoken, heard it spoken, as popularized by the great saxophonist Cannonball Adderley. A particular importance for me in that clip is the preamble that Adderley gives, or I don't know if he'd prefer to be called Cannonball, but that he gives in a live version of the song on his Best Of album. And I wrote it down so I could read it, but it's key to this podcast. So what he says, he opens by saying, "Sometimes we're not prepared for adversity. When it happens, sometimes we're caught short. We don't know exactly how to handle it when it comes up. Sometimes we don't know just what to do when adversity takes over. And I have advice for all of us. I got it from my friend Joe Zawinul, who wrote this tune, and it sounds like what you're supposed to say when you have that kind of a problem. It's called Mercy, Mercy, Mercy." So this is what Cannonball says you ought to do when you have adversity and you face a problem, is just call out for mercy. And which begs the question, obviously, is whom are we asking for mercy? Somebody, it's got to be somebody with the authority to grant it or not to grant it. You're not just, it's not just, you know, somebody's twisting your arm and you call mercy, cry uncle, all that stuff. There's somebody twisting your arm or somebody who can relieve you from that pain, whether they caused it or not. Now, when it's just circumstances, like what Cannonball is saying there, then the somebody we're crying out to mercy to essentially God. I guess if you could believe it's nature or whatever, you're just implies a sentient being, which would be God anyway. But so when we're just facing life's challenges and nobody's really to blame, we're crying out for mercy to some higher being. Now, in social and political debate, this is where we get into the critical question. When we seek mercy among other human beings, what does that mean? Well, in politics, it comes down to those, I think, for whom they're calling out to government. Government can grant you mercy. Somebody else is causing it. Government can grant you mercy. Although, you know, living in Rhode Island, we know for sure that government can certainly cause the pain for which you're crying out for mercy. But one idea is that when you're seeking mercy to address your adversity, you're going to government. And the other idea is that we go to each other and help each other out, and we act voluntarily in that regard. Now, this all ties in with a really excellent essay on Bloomberg.com by Megan McArdle. And it's why she's writing on why Utah does well, almost Scandinavian well, with economic mobility, with the ability of people who start at the bottom of the ladder to get to the top, or at least get pretty far up the top. And McArdle, if you haven't heard of her, she's relatively conservative, libertarian-ish. I believe she's gay. I'm not 100% sure about that. But so she's more on the libertarian wing. You see her a lot on, say, Instapundit.com, reference to her quite frequently, particularly on healthcare, but on a bunch of other stuff too. So she went to Utah to see, or Salt Lake City specifically, to see why they might do so well helping each other out there. So just to put some numbers on it, in Salt Lake City, the chance of a child born in the bottom fifth of all income to get to the top fifth is 10.8%. For some comparison, Denmark, I think, leads the world at 11.7%. So Salt Lake City is really close to that. And now, obviously, by the math, the perfect evenness in society would mean that 20% of the people who start at the bottom would get to the top, or something to the effect. That's McArdle's statement. Now, I'll probably revisit this particular essay many times in print and here and elsewhere, because it really starts to get to some key points that I'm interested in, and that in particular the Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity, for which I work, we're looking more into this kind of a question and proposing solutions that take it into consideration. So I'll probably be revisiting this a lot. But in essence, McArdle draws out a few reasons why Salt Lake City and Utah more generally does well helping people. First is that the church, the Mormon church, handles a lot of welfare itself. Not everything goes to government. The Mormon church has a large facility where they handle charity. They actually grow and manufacture and stuff there as part of church activity, mission type activity. Much of it is given away as in charitable purposes, and some of it sold to raise money for the church and for additional charity. So that's one reason. And key to that is that when the church, and I say this about charity, and others say it's not a unique point to me, when charity is voluntary, when people are doing it because they care about other people, they get to do things the government can't do, like set some kind of expectations for the person receiving it. They can cut them off at any time. There's not this sense that they're owed. But I'll get back to that in a minute. Another reason McArdle cites is that there is a lot of, particularly with the shared culture of having such a homogeneous society, is you get this mingling of people, particularly students in school, where the children interact with people of different social standing, social economic standing. And importantly, because it's so tied up with Mormon values, and, you know, if you picture the typical Mormon, it's the button-down shirt, you know, the sort of middle-class values, that's what's elevated. So when the kids at the bottom mingle with kids in the middle or the top, they've all... this local society is enforcing a bit more of a sense that the people who are doing well are where you want to be. They're not perfect, obviously, but they're sort of the models. They're the ones whom the other children and families should look toward for some guidance in how you should act. Third thing is that part of that ideal means the promotion of marriage and fidelity and having children within marriage and staying married. Marriage is a big, important idea that helps structure society and helps people who are on the lower end advance. And obviously, McArdle, with reference to some history of overt racism among the Mormons in Utah, and as we see in Scandinavia, and this is the conservatives' big come back when people cite socialism in Scandinavia, which isn't true. But anyway, it's easier to have this kind of community when you're racially and culturally similar. So that eases things a little bit. And I'll get into that a bit more in a minute. But now the contrast with this, and this is more my inference than McArdle's writing, but the contrast with this is the sort of the divisive method of using government to force change and to impose charity, which should be a contradiction in terms, but in much of the country, especially up here in the Northeast or other coastal liberal type areas, it's not. They definitely think you can impose charity on the giver and probably the receiver as well. So in that case, contrasting with McArdle's 4 points, you've got government welfare, that brings, as we talked about, I think last week, this welfare psychosis, which is the term Andrew Clavin introduced me to, which is a sense of entitlement, and it breeds division between those who feel entitled and those who feel like they're just being forced to support somebody else, whether or not they can. And the people who are being taxed for this government charity can get to feel like they're being made suckers of, and they're being taken advantage of by people who want to supply the services and the people who want to receive them. And that's what I've called the government plantation model, where the government takes people on as charitable cases who need government services, which gives them the pretense to go out and take money from somebody else, whether it's local taxpayers or the federal government. As far as this people mingling, particularly in school, in our area of the country, the mingling tends to elevate the victims and the bad behavior. Government caters to them, to help them. So they become the special group that gets the focus and the attention. You can picture a teacher giving positive attention, showing positive attention and giving positive feedback and showing concern for the child who's disrupting the class, more than the child who's behaving and is modeling good behavior. And this comes to mind because I forget the guy's name. He did a video about Brown University, and now he's done one about Yale, a short, just very brief 12-minute documentary about the outburst a few years ago when one of the Yale faculty said something about, hey, you know, maybe we shouldn't be censoring people's Halloween costumes. That was basically all she wrote in an email. And it became this huge outburst where the students, especially minority students, sort of cornered her husband, and who was also a professor there, and started shouting at him and having breakdowns there and telling him he's a disgrace and he won his job. And a few years later, you look back and those two professors are gone. Students were never, as far as I know, were never censured for their behavior. So that's the behavior that gets results. That's the behavior that in our part of the country, in more liberal parts of the country, we raise up to get what you want. This is how you behave to get the positive results you want. And then that ties into in parallel or contrast to a culture of a strong marital culture, a celebration of aberrant behavior, attacking institutions like marriage that somebody proclaims to be oppressive. McArdle herself notes, and this is important too. She knows for one thing that there is a strong LGBTQ community in Salt Lake City. It is a city, after all. But it's also in harmony with a lot of the points of the local culture, and they manage to compromise on things like same-sex marriage more than in the rest of the country, where it's imposed one way or the other. But she points out that in a culture where marriage is strong, it helps all children, even especially those whose parents are divorced or one's dead or whatever. And that's what I've always said with my big concern is that, and this, somebody makes this point explicitly in her article, the people who make these sorts of decisions for society, the lawmakers and judges and just commentators, tend to be people who are better off and live more responsible lives themselves in general. So they don't need this strong marriage culture. They're going to behave well anyway, or at least they've got the resources to compensate if they don't behave well and something bad happens. They can weather that storm. So people like that, people like me and probably most people listening to this, we're investing in this culture of marriage, not taking out of it so much. We're making it the expectation so that it's a model for other families to follow. And that's an important point for these people in Utah who are, they're receiving help from the church, which comes with, McArdle stresses, which comes with expectations that you're not on this forever. If you're on it for more than a year, somebody says, then we're going to look and somebody's not doing what they should be, whether it's the person receiving or the people trying to help that person. Somebody's not getting this person up and on their feet and then moving, which is the point. But even children who fall between the cracks live in this culture, they absorb this culture, and they see marriage as an ideal. They can picture it as something in their future, whereas in some of our urban societies where there's so many single mothers and such, that becomes the expectation. People, the children say, this is, if I turn out to be a father as a male, the expectation isn't that I'll be around. And if I turn out to be a girl who becomes pregnant and has children, you know, that's kind of the expectation. So in looking at these contrasts, it occurs to me that maybe it's less that Utah's society is doing something right than that liberalism or progressivism in the rest of America is doing something very wrong, maybe with good intentions, maybe. That's not a foregone conclusion, but even with good intentions, bad results because we're not paying attention to incentives and how things actually work. In this line, I wanted to bring up a clip from Dan York's radio show. He was talking with Senator Lou Raptakis of Coventry, who's been advocating for years for a minimum wage that we just set it and put it on an adjustment for cost of living and let it go. And that's it. We're done talking about it. It's no longer a political football. And Dan was pushing back on him a little bit about how, well, you know, some kids don't need this, you know. So the minimum wage, if we set the minimum wage at a certain point, the young kids don't need it, and families still can't live on it. And here is Senator Raptakis's reply.
We'll call it a living wage. Call it a wage that if you have dependents, if it's a family, a single mom with 2-3 kids, one kid, a family trying to struggle, maybe this should be a different type of wage for those that you said earlier cannot survive on $40,000 because they have to raise 2-3 children.
So what he's saying there is that we'll have a minimum wage, which you don't necessarily have to live on, and therefore it can be lower. And then maybe we have a separate thing, and that'll be a living wage, separated out by some kind of metric. So the idea seems to me to be kind of terrible, right? to put it nicely, I guess, because if we're talking about a living wage, and so there's a separate wage for people depending on their circumstances, then people trying to make a living by running a business will avoid hiring those workers, because if minimum wage is $10 and living wage is $15, the moment that your employee becomes eligible for whatever the criteria are for the living wage, suddenly you've just 50% increase in that the cost of that employee to you as an employer, and this creates all kinds of terrible incentives. Now, so imagine a couple, an unmarried couple, doesn't qualify. So a woman working a job gets minimum wage at $10, say. Now, if there's a living wage that as soon as that woman's a single mother raising a child gets $15, if she gets pregnant, even if she's for all intents and purposes married, there's incentive for she and her significant other not to make it official, not to make it a marriage, and then to have children and keep children, because then she's getting a 50% increase in her wages. And I saw this working on a docs where at least one of the people with whom I worked explicitly told me that he'd been together with his significant other for a long, long time, but they weren't getting married because then they'd lose all the benefits. So these incentives get created. And not only that, but imagine the increasing fingers of government in your business to prevent this sort of discrimination where employers would try to pick employees who get the actual minimum wage. That's very, very reckless. Maybe once, and to draw themes together here, maybe once upon a time we could have had such a living wage type thing that required marriage or created incentives for marriage, and that would be the marker. That would be your marker of a family that's eligible for a higher wage, even if we were going to go down there. But now that assumes that marriage is about children, and we've eliminated that assumption as part of the whole push for same-sex marriage. So marriage is no longer a good gauge for that, just like Christian organizations can no longer use marriage as a marker for their services, because it's not getting at the familial relationships that made it useful for as a guideline before. And the other problem, obviously, is that just even listen to Senator Raptakis or even Dan in his part of the conversation, minimum wage becomes like this matter of entitlement. And in this case, it's not even a government giving it. It's the government forcing an employer to give it. So wages, in that sense, stop being an agreement between equals. The employer and the employee being equal. So now we're putting a dividing line between them. It's no longer an exchange, but it's something that the boss owns those who deign to work for the business. And you can see, as a matter of practical theory, that how that gets in the way of economic mobility. Now you're no longer an employee in a position of equality, although making less, working for somebody else. You're in a category, the lower income category. So you're in that 20%. And even right there, you're decreasing the odds of how that person in the bottom can get to the top, because they don't see themselves getting there. They see themselves in the group that's owed something by the people who are there. And if you're owed something by them, there's an insinuation that the boss doesn't deserve to be where he is. So you don't see that path up to deserving to be the boss so much. And of course, last, it doesn't quite relate to my overall theme here, but I don't know what makes both Dan and Raptakis were talking about this as if it would resolve the minimum wage political battle every session, every year. And I don't see what makes them think that having a CPI plan or a separate living wage plan would make it the last work. If it's a CPI plan, you're going to get this push for the living wage. And in both cases, you're going to get the annual push to ramp it up. Because if somebody finds it politically expedient right now to push for minimum wage every year, they're going to find it politically expedient in the future too. So you gain nothing. And at the same time, you create this sense of entitlement and division and disrupt the economy and put businesses out of work. I don't know how we even get to where we have these conversations as if they might be a good idea. Now, in another area that the sort of these liberal progressive views of culture prevent us from having an equal society with spread out economic mobility is race. And I'm just going to quote from McArdle here on race in Salt Lake City. Quote, "This near absence of racial diversity means that racism is largely left out of Utah's conversations about economic inequality. That leads to some conversations around inequality that would be unbearably fraught elsewhere. When poor people are, by and large, the same race as the richer ones, people find it easier to talk about them than the way they might talk about, well, family members. As folks who may have made some mistakes, or started out with some disadvantages, but also as folks who could be self-sufficient after a little help from an uncle or a sister." I'd go, so basically what she's saying is that put aside issues of racism, when your society is homogeneous, that you can see each other as family, and that allows a sympathy. And she could go a little farther, in my view, to, you know, sense of responsibility. You feel like you can be lovingly critical of family members in a way you can't be of non-family members. And so that plays into a lot. So the problem is, in my view, that this doesn't have to be the case for a diverse society, that we can't see each other as siblings, brothers, sisters. We can, to quote somebody famous, we can judge each other by the content of our character and not the color of our skin. But liberal progressive racialism makes that hard. It makes it difficult to behave that way, because we're all walking on eggshells, and there's the mindset of identity groups prevents us from feeling like we're not part of identity groups. And this struck me especially this week when I heard Jim Vincent of the Rhode Island NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He's the director of the Rhode Island branch. And he was on Rhode Island Public Radio with Ian Donis and Scott McKay during their Q&A, their online extension of their political roundtable show. And just listen to this.
The only reason why these voter IDs set of propping up all over the country, in my opinion, is because of the election of President Barack Obama. Before his election, nobody talked about fraud in elections. It was a direct response to the fact that we had a first black president in the country, and a lot of people couldn't deal with it. And they said, hey, we got to do something with the increasing populations of color and the young people and whatever. Well, you know, we can't outpopulate these groups, so maybe we can suppress these votes by doing things that on its face seem reasonable.
just think about how nasty that insinuation is if it's not true. I mean, it's critical to what if it's true, then it's a reasonable observation. If it's not true, then it's a terrible insinuation, and nobody on the panel called Vincent on this. And the fact is that for as far as voter ID is concerned, it's not true. A quick look, some 18 or so of all the laws, such laws in a country, were enacted before there was a President Obama. So it's just not true. And the insinuation that people would only be concerned about the integrity of the voting process when they want to suppress people of a race, I mean, that's just a mean, terrible thing to say of people. And so when that's the attitude coming from Mr. Vincent here, it's a lot. It's like a big, how can you go, metaphorically or symbolically hug people as if they're your family when they're slapping you, saying things like that, or the kids who are shouting at the Yale professors? They literally were saying, you, one of them actually went up to the professor and said, "Look me in the eye," and he repeated that a few times. And this kid, to this celebrated professor who does great work around the world, "Look me in the eye," as if, you know, he's the instructor of the professor, and saying, "You cannot understand my situation," or something to that effect. How can we be like family when that attitude is being cultivated in our society? It's very disturbing. It's this kind of rhetoric that keeps us apart. Now, of course, this is Vincent's gig. If insinuations of racism are acknowledged to be presumptuous and even nasty, then he's out of a gig. You know, what's the point then? That's his whole shtick. That's why he's on the radio, to say things like that. But the institutional incentive for opinion leaders in places like Rhode Island and in the Northeast and coastal areas is to make these statements and prevent us from seeing each other as family. And it creates more division, creates more reasons why people on the bottom can't get to the top, why people on the outside can't get inside. And on that note, I wanted to play something that really jumped out on me on a recent episode of Crime Town, a really awesome podcast available through Gimlet by Mark Smerling and Zach Stewart Pontier. And they were doing a show about one episode about Arlene Violet as Attorney General pushing back on, quote, the network that caused and perpetuates the society that caused the credit union crisis in Rhode Island in the early 90s. But this one part, this will hit you in the gut.
In places like Rhode Island, corruption becomes part of the culture. And it forces everyone to make a cruel choice. Join in or be a sucker.
Join in or be a sucker. You can't put it any better than that. But I mean, that's how it is in Rhode Island, and that's how it is in way, way too much of the country. But there has to be another option. I mean, the practical problem is it's just so hard to get there. Even just to make minor changes in how we see each other and how we interact and how we use government to take from each other and not take from each other, or give each other, allow each other to do things or not allow each other to do things. Even at the local level, it's huge, huge work with very little individual payoff. And it subjects you, when you want to challenge this culture of corruption and insiderness and division and racism and racialism, you're subject to constant attacks. I mean, I get attacked on Facebook and so on by people, kids in high school who think, "Hey, I can go after this guy. He's nobody. I can," you know, in a more healthier society, we would see that for what it is. That's the adults diminishing other people. But to push back on this and get a healthy society, it's just very difficult. And the incentives do not align with it. So I don't know how we get past that. And to close out, McArdle's conclusion, is, quote, "The values of the Mormon Church may create a public that simply needs less help." Now, take out the Mormon thing, and isn't that what we should be striving for? Where people don't need our help, and we'll help them as family when they need it, but that we're trying to get them to where they're independent and don't need it, and we're all equals. I mean, that's the goal, isn't it? I think we can do it here. It's just going to take a lot more of us. asking each other for mercy, mercy, mercy on the enforcement of corruption and division. Anyway, that's it for this time around. Episode number 999, number 9, number 9, number 9. As always, the links relevant to this podcast are on the post that it's associated with on oceanstatecurrent.com. And as always, I'll be thrilled to get feedback on anything you want to say, good, bad, indifferent. Well, not indifferent. I don't like that much so much. So, in the meantime, remember, mercy, 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 maybe with a little spring in your step, too.